One thing I wanted to ask about was the way in which you assimilate food. You said it was similar. You assimilate out of the food what was similar to yourself.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the way in which you tend to group with similar people.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if there was a link there kind of made in this constant gathering of similars.
Yeah. But can you see logically why only like substances can assimilate? You know, for instance, if you take the organic compounds, you're really dealing with nitrogen compounds, aren't you?
Oh, yes, it is.
You must have something that is in some way similar to many things if you wish to bind a lot of things together.
Is that like the catalyst again?
Similar, except that in the catalyst you have a substance that doesn't itself take part in the reaction. It's just its presence that determines it. Like we said before, that consciousness is a catalyst. If you see a child playing and it doesn't know that you have noticed it and you keep looking at it, very soon the child alters the character of the play. It's aware that it's under observation, and the fact that it is being watched changes the character of the action. And the same thing happens as any human being. The moment he becomes conscious of what he is doing, then the action tends to change itself. Consciousness in that sense is a catalyst, because consciousness does not itself participate in anything whatever. It is just the permanent background of all the activities. You can say, if you like, that everything, every percept is inside consciousness. The consciousness itself is not of them, but they are of it. They're like the ripples on the sea. The ripples can fall down and leave the sea there calm. You can imagine the sea calm without ripples, but you can't imagine the ripples without the sea, which establishes the priority of substance, doesn't it? This is well to make a if we draw ourselves a wave and a body of water, we can say that the body of water represents substance, plastic substance, and these waves now are the basis of the possibility of counting. If we draw another body of water here, calm, we say that is one surface, don't we? Because it is flat. At the moment waves come in, we can start counting the waves. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. This is like the tooth side of a saw. We call this the discrete aspect. Discrete means grown apart. This is the discrete aspect of the phenomenal world. There is the substantial world, whatever it might be, all this stuff, as we call it in the Anglo-Saxon. This is the materia of the Latins, the stuff, substance, the hema or wood of the Greeks. And this is the carving of the wood, or the rippling of the plastic substance. Here we have continuity on the bottom. Ships may pitch and toss, and sailors may complain up there as much as they like. Down below, a sunken ship is in calmness, isn't it? This is very, very similar to the human mind. The ripples in the human mind are caused by forces acting on the mind from outside, which we call stimuli. But in the depth of the mind, the stimulus from outside cannot produce great disturbances. Which means that fundamentally everybody is quite calm. Would you like to put that in again? So that it works. I had another one over there somewhere. Yeah. Anyhow, this question of assimilation now, we know that unless a substance has some factor identical with another substance, it cannot fuse with it. I suppose we consider that all matter is vibrating in a certain way. We can then, if we like, say some matter has a characteristic wave form like that, and there's its baseline from which it starts. Now, supposing we take the string of a musical instrument, this is how Pythagoras would have done it, and we allow that string to vibrate, supposing we pull it down there, and then let it fly across, it will then assume this position, and then that position, won't it? And it will give a beat that we call the fundamental. But if we stimulate this string in various ways, plucking it, a wave will break through the middle there. We can put a finger there on a violin string, and we will then get, if that finger is halfway from there to there, we'll get the octave of this fundamental note. That means if that fundamental is, say, middle C on the piano, then putting the finger halfway along it will give you the C above it, which has double the frequency. Which means if we take this character, we can reproduce it here, and say that the wavelength of that is half as long as that, but the frequency is double. This question of assimilation is very closely linked, because in effect it means that if we take the universe itself as a big sphere, and take the diameter of it as the fundamental, then we can say there is a definite vibration which to the appropriate tympanum, to the appropriate sensitive organ, say the divine ear, would sound a fundamental. And then if we divide it in the middle and stop it here, there would be an octave higher sounding there and there on both sides, which we would call musically a parcel. And if we stopped this again half here, this would be an octave higher than this one, and half again, that would be an octave higher, half an octave higher still. This is going up into smaller and smaller divisions. And we see that the wavelengths of these parts are getting shorter. So we can then say that if we take this as the whole universe, and that is the diameter of it, and then proceed to subdivide it until we can no longer divide it anymore, we have reached the shortest wave in the universe, haven't we? So we could then make a gamut of waves, the longest wave, the full diameter of the universe, and the shortest wave would be something like Schrödinger's wave at all. Somewhere on the other side of the electron. Very, very tiny wave, very short wave, of very high frequency. There are many of those per second of time. So, supposing we say that if we make some food, we'll draw a circle here, we say food is just something that can be assimilated. You see the difference between the word good and food? It's G and F, isn't it? Now this concept, ud, or ad ed, means to eat, in the root in edible. The Sanskrit ad is also the same thing, ud. We say food, food. Good means the gross matter of food. So we say we get something, is it good for you? You put it inside, and send it down there, break it up, and if you can assimilate it and come out better, you call it good. But if instead of being able to assimilate it, it starts disrupting you, you call it a poison. So we can see that this circle can be assimilated by this big one because it's half the fundamental. So it has a natural resonance, doesn't it? And we could say that there's another one in here that could be assimilated by this one. And halfway there's another one. And there's another one. There's another one. You can see that all these small frequencies can be absorbed by the big one, can't they? But if we go on cutting these down in this manner, we'll find that some of them will not assimilate with each other because of the relation between odd and even counts. When we cut that, we get 2. We cut it again, 4, 8, 16. We haven't got something yet that we can divide by 3, have we? You see that? So if we go on up and up and up, we find that the odd numbers will not assimilate with the even. You know, Pythagoras said odd numbers are male, which means that they are active. Even numbers are balanced, equilibrated, and therefore feminine. Number 5, he said, means marriage, because it contains 2 and 3. The female number 2, first female number, the equilibration, balance, gives passivity, doesn't it? Perfect equilibrium is the same as passivity. And an odd number is a stimulus. There's an odd one in 3. 1 itself is not odd, that's the whole that we begin with. You see, the funny thing about elementary arithmetic is that the behaviour of 1 and 2 are not like the behaviour of other numbers. We say 1 plus 1 equals 2, and 2 times 1 is 2. So whether you add or multiply 1, you get the same result, don't you? But if we take the number 2, we say 2 times 2 are 4, and 2 plus 2 are 4, you see, and that behaves like 1, doesn't it? The same result whether you add or multiply. But when we come to number 3, if you say 3 plus 3 is 6, and 3 times 3 are 9, so suddenly there's a new emergence. And therefore there's a special kind of mathematics for dealing with the peculiar behaviour of 1 and 2. So 1 and 2 must be considered as, first, this big one, the one, the whole one, and all these are parts. Now the word part itself is a rational cut of pirat. And that pi ratio is the function. You see, here's the radius, and this is a parat, a part. The parrot, the parrot bird is so called because it says things parrot. Yeah. Rationally rotating them, whatever you feed in, it plays back. If we keep cutting this in 2 and 2, we will always find that this half can be assimilated by this and this and this. But when we divide it in 3, we get a note which in music is called a fifth. It's strange that they should call it a fifth, but it's really a third of the length of the string. But there is a way of reconciling that. But the point is that that third will not vibrate harmoniously with that half. So that it cannot be assimilated by it. But if we take factors of odd and even numbers and build them up, we can arrive at a number that can assimilate both odd and even, can't we? So, well, supposing we take 3 5s. Now, that will assimilate 2 odd numbers, 1, 2, 3, and 5. If we take 3 4s, it assimilates an even number and an odd number. So there's something mysterious about 12, isn't there? Because it can assimilate an odd and an even number. We're excluding 1 and 2 because they're special cases. The reason why they're special cases, this is 1. 1 inside and 1 outside. That makes 2. The 1 outside is infinite. And the one inside is finite. So 1 and 2 are very, very special cases. But from the point of 3 onward, the first synthetic number, 1 isn't synthetic, it's unanalyzed. The first synthetic odd number is 3. And the next is 4, and 3 times 4 is 12. So in 12 we have a means of assimilating short frequencies derived from the third and from the half. You can cut the half into a half, quarters, 8, 16, and the third into 6, 12, and so on. So this question of the fundamental beat of matter is very important. If we wanted to, we could cut that into 13 times 7 plus 1, which would give us the atomic scale, namely 92 elements, ignoring isotopes for the time being. When we come down to the smallest particle, it is a definite subdivision of the diameter of the universe, which means to say that it has a definite resonance relation with other parts of the universe. That means that there is something in man, namely his physical body, which is made of the earth, which is made of primary elements vibrating at definite wavelengths, which are necessarily related to the planetary cycle, the whole mass of matter in the solar system, and to an octave structure, the sun itself, and then to the sidereal system, and then to the whole universe. So
so that their matter is no more than a series of subdivisions right down to the smallest subatomic particle there is, which has a definite periodicity function, a definite frequency of its own and a wavelength. And the whole question of assimilation, therefore, is fundamentally one of frequency. If we get a saw and we make its teeth like this, and we get another saw with the teeth exactly the same pitch, they fit. If we get another saw where the teeth don't fit, then it cannot assimilate. We can't put them together. Now, in the case of measuring on a vernier, we have this sort of sawtooth, don't we? And a finer sawtooth. And at some point, there will be a coincidence. There's one there on here accidentally. And the rest of them will be out. Now, if you remember, we said before, if you take the six-pointed star and put a five-pointed star in it, if we put one point of the five on one of the six, the rest are out of phase. So you can assimilate through one sense when you are concentrated, and therefore not through the others at the same time. So fundamentally, we can say that this question of assimilation is one of frequency, and that every particle of food that you eat, every drug, every chemical, is made of fundamental frequencies that must go into their own places somewhere along this diameter line of the universe. Now, what we call thinking in a man is really formal presentation, serially, isn't it? For instance, if we say, think of a cube as a cube, now that is an image. Plato would have said that's the lowest kind of thinking there is, because it's imposed on us. When we see that, we can tell that that peculiar thing isn't the same as a crescent. And we cannot be deceived by that to think that it's that. It doesn't allow us to do so. So in that sense, we are slaves if we work at the sense perception level. Because perceiving, say, these compasses close, and then we open them, it's not very smart to be able to tell that they're open when we do this and closed when we do this. It's an imposition. So man's freedom does not consist in the sense world, because the sense world merely reflects what there is outside. This is why she said that man's freedom is within. Man is not free in his relation with the external world, because it imposes upon him, giving him the so-called sense data, which are what they are, whether he likes it or not. So we've got this idea that assimilation is fundamentally no more than the actual resonance of already related partials of a string, which in its widest sense may be called the diameter of the universe. Now, when a person is thinking, there is also a definite frequency in his mind. If he looks at the light imposes on him. If he looks for a long time, and then looks against a dark curtain, he will then see an after image from the light begin to superimpose itself. If you look at the light until it fills your eye with light and you begin to see colours around it, and turn into a dark place, the light will form itself, and you will then find that it will start drifting about. And with a little bit of practice, you can cause it to come near to you, which is a very peculiar thing. You can actually make it come very close so you can examine the details. Although it really was up there, you begin to have a certain amount of power over it, because you are now dealing with something that is half from outside and half from inside. And the nearer it is to your inside, the greater the degree of freedom you have over it. Now, every frequency has a very definite chemical characteristic. And you know that when we're examining the chemistry of stellar bodies with a prism, we use spectrum analysis to determine the presence of sodium or other elements in stars. If a surface reflects light to us, we can tell by the characteristic colours in the spectrum what chemicals are there. That is, of course, ordinary physical science. What is not usually realised is this, that an emotion is also a frequency, and it has a very definite relationship with particular material substances, a frequency relationship. such that if you eat certain food, you are absorbing frequencies which will tend to make you think and feel in a certain way. If you take certain, supposing we said that is a certain substance, and you eat it, well then all the partials, that is the seven divisions of that, will vibrate in you as well. And at the top level here, it is an identity of ideation, thinking and emotion. So that it is upon this that the restrictions about diet are based in yoga. Namely, that thought itself is a kind of motion with a definite frequency and wavelength, with definite relations to the foods that you eat. So that if you are in a certain mood, you can assimilate certain foods, and if you're in another mood, you may be unable to assimilate the same food. Sometimes you find a fellow saying, I've just been put off my food by so-and-so. He had a good appetite, and he was about to eat, and then up spake Spurius Lartius or somebody, and suddenly his appetite is gone. Now why? The food is the same, the man is the same, but a stimulus has come, stimulated something in his memory, and altered his fundamental frequency, so that now he cannot deal adequately with that food. If you persuade him to swallow it, it does not follow that his stomach can deal with it. It might lie very heavily on his stomach for a long time. So that really you have to tune yourself in to the food that you get.
But if for instance, you start to receive new ideas, it might start you to want to eat different kinds of food.
Oh yes, well you know that in the case of a pregnant woman, don't you? You know that they have, they start thinking they want things that they didn't want before. And those are genuine things, they're not empty fantasies. They are chemical needs. There's a certain chemical need for making the child, which previously they did not themselves need because they hadn't got that kind of emotion. Sometimes a woman may think to herself, I'm such and such a being, and then suddenly she has a child and she thinks she's another kind of being because chemical changes have occurred. She may be all right to live at a certain level, and then when she changes her level emotionally, she changes her chemical need, because there is nothing in the universe, whatever it is, a gross material, subtle material, which is the mind itself is a very fine matter, and the soul feeling, the soul specifically is the sentiency, being, feeling, and spirituality are all matters of frequency. Whatever is has a definite beat, and the top beat of all is the beat that we call spirituality. Below that there is the psychic one, and then below that smaller and smaller we're concerned with the gradual appearance of these partials, which are gross matter as far as we're concerned. So that no matter what it is, you can think of it in terms of these teeth. Do they fit or do they not? Supposing we take all the people in this room who at the moment may be assumed to be interested in certain aspects of this subject. If they're interested in the same aspect, they must be using the same frequency. Sometimes in a spiritualist circle you get a request that everybody sits round and lets the finger of the hand, so the little finger touch the thumb of the next person, all sit in a circle and then all concentrate on one thing. Well, the purpose of doing that is to persuade the mind to beat in unison. Because when you've got unity, you have power. If you've got unity in your own being, you've got power. Whereas if you have too many purposes which cannot be logically related, then your power, although it is there, is dispersed in various directions and does not appear as effective power because it lacks unity.
I begin to see the idea now that if you're using up energy at a certain frequency, you're going to require to take out of the food to replace that energy at that frequency.
Yes, yes.
That's correct.
Well, it will be shown scientifically that if a man eats exactly the same food, supposing we say to a man, here's some mashed potatoes, and we mash them up to get a more or less homogeneous consistency, and then we divide them arbitrarily in half and say, now I want you to eat this half today, and I'm going to tell you funny stories while you eat it. And then we're going to take the excrement and measure the chemistry in it. And tomorrow you're going to eat the other half, and we're going to tell you horrible stories, not funny stories. And we'll do the same thing, and it will then be shown by resonance that the man has taken something out of the one that he hasn't taken out of the other. This is going on all the time. This is why you can't get the same diet to work for different people in the same way. This is why you can't get the same drug, which will give you, say, let's take penicillin, which is a wonder drug of the journalists. Yet, its percentage of successes, which is a statistical statement, is such, I think about 4 years ago, it was about 15% of immediate success. This depends on the chemistry of the person that takes it. Giving a drug, giving any kind of treatment, whatever, where you introduce bodies from outside for assimilation, must take into consideration the type of the person that's going to receive it, this chemical type. Now, if you get a book like Culpepper's Herbal, the medicine of his day was one thing, but he was an unusual fellow, and he liked the old-fashioned way. Like Paracelsus did in many ways. In fact, Paracelsus invented this modern method of injecting metals into people for certain resonance reasons. No two people can assimilate the same substance in the same way. The same person cannot assimilate the same medicine in the same way in two separate hours.
So you can never be complete accuracy in medicine.
Well, that is why it is said to be now a statistical science. The 19th century dream that there was a definite number of material particles which, as I said, were fortuitously running about and producing accidentally a universe, and their velocities and directions being known, you should be able to write the history of the universe forwards and backwards. That was a dream. There's no correspondence at all with fact. They had never at that time seen atoms walking about and colliding and fortuitously getting together to make a frog or something. It was an assumption, a kind of dream, because the mind of man is always looking for a final explanation which, if he gets it, he thinks he can stop and fold his arms and that'll be the end of it. But the universe isn't like that. The universe is fundamentally a continuum of power, and because it is a continuum, the straight line, these things which science counts, because science is based on measurement and statistical measurement of that, these things can never tell you what's going on down here. The invention of an infinitesimal calculus is an attempt to deal with smaller and smaller and smaller distances between here, but it can't deal with nothing. There's an attempt in mathematics to deal with what are called infinite qualities. They borrowed a Hebrew letter, Aleph, and by using the term Aleph Nun, which means a number that when added, multiplied, or divided by itself to make precisely what it was the first time, namely zero, this is an attempt to get down to this substratum. Most people think it is meaningless, but it isn't. It's an attempt to discover why this baseline can produce these ripples. Why does an egg become a human being? You look inside it with a microscope, all you can see is some little strings with knobs on. If in the old days they used to think that inside an egg was a little man waiting to have his dinner and grow big. It isn't true. Inside there are some little weird granules. But somehow they are the vehicle whereby a force outside them, namely the macrocosmic force, presses into that egg and produces a man out of it. Somehow the man isn't in the egg, he's outside the egg, but he gets into the egg by pressing on it and producing modulations, which fundamentally are frequencies. You take, say, the high bridge nose of the Jews as a race. that hybridness there is a product of haughtiness of spirit, of thinking high. Each nation has a definite psychological tendency which produces a physical structure, because the modeler of form is first feeling. First the feeling, then the function, then the ratification of the function in material. So that we can say about diseases in general, they begin with feeling slightly off colour. If the person becomes hypnotised by that, or begins to think it's useful to dodge some issue, then he starts working upon this feeling, and gradually he alters his substance and produces malfunctioning. If he produces this disturbance of function over a long time, he can make an organic breakdown. An organic breakdown doesn't just start like that. It starts by some functional disorder, which starts by some feeling disorientation to begin with. So that the more we can control and elevate the feeling and make it more positive, the more unity there will appear in the physical body. The whole point in yoga terms is to become ekacitta, have a one-pointed mind. Just have one aim and subordinate everything else to that. What contradicts it has to go. Now, Ken mentioned the zodiac, and while we're talking about assimilation, we can deal with that. This circle cuts itself spontaneously into the right number. Now, if we bisect the angles between these, there's our six pointer. That fits exactly. And we bisect these angles, we produce our 12 divisions. This is really a device which is fundamentally a new way of dealing with the macrocosmos, the big universe itself, and reducing it down to the level where it is useful to men. We draw one little circle and another and another and another for ease of analysis. We draw one circle and we'll put in it a triangle that way, and we'll write on it the sign of the ram, Leo, and Sagittarius there. And you see the ram is like a V, you probably know it. That is the so-called fire triad taken out, and actually refers to the nervous system of the human being. It means nervous energy. We invert that one and we put this triad in, and this is at the bottom Libra, and there Aquarius, and here Gemini. Now that's our air triad, which has to do with intellect, ideas, and the respiratory apparatus, the breathing apparatus in your body. Breathing is very closely linked with thinking, very closely linked with judgment. You know that when you start judging events, your breathing alters. If you decide that something is very, very bad and should be stopped, you'll find that your breathing begins to reflect your judgment. The Greek word for lungs is phren, which means mind. So they knew that there was a very close relation between thinking and breathing. And of course you can fire ideas at people and make them very excited, so that their breathing accelerates and they get palpitation. And yet you've only spoken to them. It shows the power of judgment over the breathing apparatus particularly. Now we have here the water triad. That's a triangle there with Cancer there. I better write this in the side. Right, 69 lying on its side, and that's the sign of Cancer. Scorpio down here, which is an M with an arrow on its tail, and then the sign of Pisces up there, which is two semicircles back to back, and then over here the final triad, Capricorn, which is the sign of the ram, plus the sign of Taurus. Taurus is the sign
This is a greasy thing that won't draw. Loop. And Virgo is like an M with the same loop added to it. I'll just show you those, they're a bit difficult. The sign of the ram is like that. The sign of Taurus is like that. If we add Taurus here to the ram, it's the sign of the goat, Capricorn. I'll explain why in a moment. There's Taurus on its own. We do a letter M, and then we put the sign of Taurus on the top of the sign. So in these three earth signs, we're using the sign of Taurus three times. And that's because that Taurus means to turn. Taurus, you see? That's rota. See? All matter is rotation of power. So when we're talking about the matter of your body, we're talking about rotations of power. And therefore, Taurus, this turning thing, you can spell that T-A-U if you like, or you can, this is a Hebrew way of spelling it. One way is Greek, if you spell it with an O there. It's Latin if you spell it with a U and an A-U there. But the fundamental concept is T-R, which is the rotor concept. So, in the case of the earth signs, to deal with your gross physical body, which manifests in the specifically in the bone structures, which are the nearest things to the mineral world, aren't they? They're the parts that when you get hold of a living human being and boil him until the flesh falls off, there's something that's still there, that's the bone. And that's the really earth part of you. The rest of the stuff, if you get a living man and heat him up, you'll drive off the most volatile substances first, and you'll find various sediments chemically afterwards. All those added together are the earth substances of the body. Now we'll consider what they are. I'm going to put I'll put the sign of the ram in here for a moment. Should have been at the top. We'll call that 12 o'clock. And then it goes round Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces. Now I want you to think about this as a psychosomatic device. It tells you something about your mind and something about your body at the same time. When we come to consider the earth signs, that's Capricorn, Taurus and Virgo, we can see very clearly what it means. This means assimilation, absorption. This Capricornian, the goat, is the being that has a go at anything. You know that the symbol of the goat in the Old Testament is that person who throws himself into the situation and gets into trouble, and therefore we talk about the scapegoat. A being that pays the price of other people's carefulness in dangerous situations. There's always one that can't quite control himself and rushes forward first. And he is the one who is blamed, although everybody wants him to do the same thing. So this fellow who must have a go at is called the goat. And you know that the goats in general are not herded in the plains like sheep. They jump on the mountain tops. So that when it says the separating of the sheep and the goats in the Revelation, it means separating those independent spirits that are always trying to do it on their own from the mass spirit called sheep. And where the goats have to go and where the sheep have to go is not necessarily a bad thing. Goats, where the goats go, and that's where they like to go. It is called hell to sheep, because the sheep like to keep together. But the goats like to be independent. This is why Jakob Boehme says that the angel is called the good good, but the devil is called the bad good. So, this is your primary absorption of matter. So a person born with a stress on there is really pitched in this
necessity of absorbing matter through food. And this sign means secretion. It has to do with the glandular system. The food that you have absorbed, you now hide it in certain centers in the body, glands of internal secretion. And you store it there, and you let a bit of it out every now and then, it goes around the body. And this one has to do with the circulation of the food. So that's three processes: taking the food in, hiding the food in particular parts of the body, at the glandular system, and then circulating it to produce a balanced whole. Remember we said last week that the chemistry of the different parts of the human body, the blood, is not the same. The chemistry of the blood in the brain is not the same as the chemistry of the blood in your thigh muscles, because each part of the body has some substance being manufactured and poured into it at that part, so there's high saturation of a certain chemical from a gland, and far away there's less saturation than that, and something else is the dominant influence. So that the same chemical injected into one part of the body of the same man will not produce the same effect if you inject it into another part of the same man, because it's chemically different in different places. I mentioned Culpepper before. He said, it is no good knowing the right remedy unless you've got the right man to give it to, and it's time. And when he said it's time, he meant to say that there's a definite relation in resonance between something that most people today would tend to scoff at, but not modern scientists, they're very cautious now. Namely, that certain plants have definite relationships with certain planets. They were said anciently to be under the dominion of Mars, of Venus, and so on. We know that all vegetable life has very, very close statistical relationship with the planet Venus. We know that the coffee in Brazil is largely determined by the Venusian cycle. And we know that the moon itself has a profound effect on germination. This statistically, which is the same thing as saying scientifically. And the scientists, therefore, are today considerably less dogmatic about this. And he said, if a planet is ruling a certain plant, and you take that plant and abstract from it a certain chemical, and give it to a man who is antipathetic to that planet, it won't help him, it will annoy him. We talk about men as being, say, in ancient terms, we might have said a man is choleric. He's a man that tends to fly into bad tempers. He's an angry man, and so on. They had four types of men. And those four types are still valid, and they're involved in here, as we will see. The first, the absorption, taking in, the storing or secretion in particular places, then the rotation or circulation of those to maintain harmony of the body. That is for the physical things. We'll come back to them again in a minute. Now we take the water signs, so-called, which have to do with all the fluids in your body. All the fluid substances. And these are peculiarly related to your feeling. Just like the bones are a lever system related to your motor activities. So, the water signs are related to the fluids in your body. And when we start with cancer, it means the whole of the fluids in your body. When we talk about Scorpio, it means particulars. And when we talk about Pisces, it means, like Virgo meant, the circulation, again, the relating factor. So a person with this stress has a diffused feeling awareness, the cancer type. The Scorpio type has gathered his feeling together and is a very zealous man. Zeal is his essential characteristic. And the Pisces type is an emotional man. He's whizzing it round and it tends to fly out. There's a certain amount of unity in Scorpio, but it manifests as zeal and drive. There's a lot of disunity emotionally in Pisces. It tends to speak itself out in many, many diverse ways. But it's all to do with the fluids of the body and with the life of feeling. So that's like the psyche. These signs are like the gross physical body. This is like the soul life, the feeling life. When we come to the air signs, Libra means perception. Just like we said, taking in gross matter there, taking in fluids in general, we're now saying taking in sense data. First we must perceive. When we've perceived, then we unify them all in the memory. So that Aquarius, the so-called water carrier, water has plasticity. It is the form retainer. First perceive, then remember, then evaluate. So Gemini means judgment or evaluation. That's why we've got this two pillars, the right and left hand of the Solomonic temple. Whole perception, seeing as much as you can, storing it up in the memory, and judging from it. And that is the intellectual triad. It has to do with your breathing apparatus. As a matter of fact, if you try deliberately to perceive a lot of things, doesn't matter what they are, if you just took the contents of that table and tried to go around them and just seen them as quickly as you could, you'd find your breathing had accelerated. Maybe to try to do it. Although they're not particularly exciting things there, I don't think. Not any funny novels there. Nevertheless, if you actually tried to force yourself just to see them, you will start accelerating your breathing process. And that's very closely linked with your heart, which is the centre of your circulation system. Now, when we come to this trial, we get nervous energy as a whole, which would give a great belief in capacity, very quick mind, and tending to dominate, or hoping to dominate the situation, because they feel that they have the nervous energy to do so. But that's only the general feeling of it, not the particular. When we come into Leo, it has become gathered together into a ball, and therefore we say that Leo is the peculiar sign of willfulness. It is the sign of the will. And then we come here to that which balances these two. This is the individuated will, and that is the general, and this one goes in between both. So this one alternates between the undifferentiated nervous energy and the unified or volitional nervous energy. So that's shortly an explanation of the different parts. We'll go through them again now and look at the logic of it and see how useful it is for us if we can start off with a certain characteristic. Because this wheel was specially devised as a method of dealing with people with certain temperaments. Supposing we say, here's a person born in the sign of Gemini. We know, therefore, that he tends, I'm ignoring his heredity. Either or with them, and there's no end to it. The only way you can help that kind of person is to choose something they haven't thought of and rush them into it, which is the opposite sign. Now, the reply to every kind of behaviour is simply to play the opposite kind of behaviour. Supposing we take a person in the sign of Pisces, which is emotional activity, that is emotional activity, and straight opposite to it is Virgo. Now, the Virgoic type is solid, feels itself to be very reliable, is sure that it's the most reliable type of being that is, and in certain ways it is. And it has such a solid, stable centre in it that when emotional people are about, if a Virgo enters, it appears to be a centre of security. So the correct reply to an emotional person is not to join in and start pulling your hair out, but to go more Virgoic with yourself. Settle down and be very, very solid and think that you're made of matter. And thereby you contradict that emotional contagion. We could go around the whole circle, but it would take rather a long time to do it. I'd rather go back
and explain the logic of this process. First of all the energy in the universe before creation we may consider as a continuum. It is not synthetic because it has not yet been analysed, and we will call that the undifferentiated whole. So there's an undifferentiated nervous energy before it enters into a human being. So we can refer to that, the nervous energy, the kind of vibration that appears in a human being as nervous energy, is a definite frequency. And we call that a cardinal sign. I'll put C for cardinal. Now if we draw the George cross on here, like this, those are the cardinal signs. Undifferentiated nervous energy, the sign of the ram. Undifferentiated feeling, Cancer. Undifferentiated perception, Libra. Undifferentiated absorption of food, Capricorn. That's all undifferentiated, and that is prior to creation. But the moment that that force enters into a finite organism, like a human being, then it is no longer undifferentiated. It's like pumping air into a balloon. The air may be outside, undifferentiated. You pump it into the balloon, and straight away, if we draw the balloon inside there and draw the molecules of air that you pumped in, they're rushing about and colliding with each other and hitting on the inside of the skin and bouncing back. So that straight away they haven't got that absolutely free motion that they had outside. They are now conditioned by the fact of existing. This means to say that every force that gets inside a finite being, like a human being, like a stimulus, and a light stimulus, goes in your eye, goes in certain brain cells, but it comes to a term inside, the end of a nervous line, and it sets up a beat, and then the ripple starts all the way back again. So that in the unified state, that is the energy entered into a finite system, we pass then to the signs called fixed. And I've put here, the top sign there of the ram is undifferentiated. The opposite sign here was Libra, that's undifferentiated. Cancer is undifferentiated. And Capricorn, there's the George Cross. Now if we go clockwise, round one stage, we come to Leo. That is the first differentiation of it. And it is called a fixed sign, because the energy has now got itself fixed up in the body. Perception, passing in to a finite system, becomes memory. That is, every perception of light goes in, produces a modification in my brain, and my brain is never the same again. It has now been modified, and that modification is memory. So that the undifferentiated perception becomes memory when it enters a closed system like a human being. The undifferentiated feeling, when it enters a closed system, becomes zeal. Just in the same way if you pumped water into a balloon, this is the water triad, and pump it and pump it and pump it, at a certain point there will be a weak place in the skin of the balloon, and it will burst there and the water will shoot out. And that is the tendency of these feeling signs. When the feeling builds up to a certain level, something must happen. And in the case of the Scorpio stress test, their whole life is driven from within by feeling. So that is then the fixed sign, Scorpio, and Taurus is the fixed sign for the Earth. Remember, we take the undifferentiated food, put it in, break it down, and then hide it in glandular structures for use for distribution later. The first signs we call the undifferentiated or cardinal. The second ones we call fixed. And the third ones we call mutable. That is, they can change. They can either be undifferentiated or fixed, because they've already done both. This has to do with reincarnation. If you've done a bit of that, and you've done a bit of that, then you can rock between them and say, well, today I'm willful, tomorrow I'm reasonable, and so on. Whereas it's very hard for these beings to be reasonable or undifferentiated, because they've only just gained their unity. So we'll find that people stressed Leo are men of will. They're wonderful pioneers. They get things done. But they really cannot rest. They cannot not do things. Things must be done, and they must be done by them. So we have to see the logic of this, that whatever it is that exists must first exist prior to creation, which is its cardinal, its carbis hinge. It is upon that everything hinges, like its stone hinge. And then it must enter into a closed system, whereupon it reverberates inside the system, and then it must burst out of the system again to regain its freedom. So those are logically the three things: energy coming in. My pencil is refusing to cooperate. Energy swings in from infinity, turns round, that's the sign of Taurus, presses into its centre, and then shoots out again. That completes the whole process, doesn't it? Solar energy comes into a plant, and by means of the chlorophyll in its leaves, it synthesizes certain elements in the atmosphere, using the sunlight as its primary energy. And after a time, leaves come shooting out, fruits come shooting out, and then it sows its seeds about, scatter. So that is the logic. First, undifferentiated, non-creative, then the creative, packing in more and more energy, and finally, the outthrow. And it's very, very important to realize that in any situation whatever, for any kind of being, every finite being, every animal, every vegetable, every human being, is in a situation where forces are coming at him, piling into his organism, and will wind up inside until they're made such a pressure that they will come out, unless he understands how to control them. Now, in the case of sexual energy, we know it's perfectly obvious. Certain forces come into the body. They're not individual forces. They have no regard whatever for individuals. They come into the body. They're determined to procreate. They periodically build up. They build up all the time, but they periodically release. So they have to start building again. The energy comes in, piles itself up, until the chemical messengers from those centers going all over the body keep saying, "Go on. Go on, it's time to release this lot of new inhabitants of the earth." And therefore, the process called ejaculation or out-shouting must occur unless some method is devised of turning them in and transforming their frequency onto another level, which it is possible to do. Psychologically, that's called sublimation. A man wants to do various naughtinesses, instead of which he decides to build the Sydney single expansion bridge. Now that can be done with it. It's possible to create a work of art with the very, very same energy lifted to another level. But it has to be understood that you're dealing with infinite energy coming into a finite system, and it will shoot out in some form of symptom, unless you understand how to change its face. So we can say that from the moment a child is born, energies are piling into its food, solar radiation, cosmic radiations of various types, and they're forcing that child to grow. The child cannot refuse to grow at that level. It must grow because energy is coming in and packing it on the inside, and it will grow to the term for its type of being. And then energies start shooting out. And when a stimulus comes from outside and hits on an energy storage, the energy storage tends to react and throw more out. So a person may be practicing self-control for a few days and think, "I'm doing very, very well." And suddenly somebody says what is called the wrong word. And then quite suddenly it's apparent that that self-control was merely a bottling process. Now it says in the Book of Words, no man can be continent except God wills. Continent means containing. It means you cannot, as a finite system, contain all those energies unless God allows you to. And that can only be if you do with it what he wants you to do. That is a method of doing it. That is to say, you can take the same energy that would fire at a particular target and deliberately think of the macrocosmic being instead, which is equivalent to doing something that God wants you to do, and then you can contain the energy. It actually changes its frequency. You can then assimilate it at a higher level, and that which was a merely physical urge is then transmuted onto a higher ideational and emotional level. It will actually solve problems for you. The same energy that would get you into trouble can get you out, providing you shift your attention from the particular onto the universal. God is concerned with reminding all creatures that they are derived from the universal and trying to persuade them to behave as if there were only one whole being with many little children internal to it, like the seeds in a pomegranate. You know, the temple of Solomon had its pillars crowned with pomegranates to symbolize that, because the pomegranate is full of seeds and it's a kind of diagram of the universe.
365, according to Janet's paper, every one. I'm waiting to tell you that.
One for each day of the year. There should be a quarter one somewhere. Anyhow, we consider this as a diagram of the four systems in the body. We have four organic systems in the body, physically and also as a psychological device. Physically, it means there is nervous energy, there is breathing, there is feeling in the fluids, and there is absorption of food. Psychologically, it means there's a very definite relationship between willfulness and nervous disorders. Because this nervous energy is that energy which becomes will when it enters into a finite being. So that people that tend to be willful are the same people that tend to be neurotic. Now, if we take the opposite of fire, that's water. The water people, in general, with the exception of Scorpio, that is ruled by Mars, they are adaptable. And they do not tend to neurosis. What they tend to is something quite different. They tend to enjoy themselves and not be too particular about what are called this world's moral considerations. They tend to be hedonists, to enjoy life, to say that life is for pleasure and for the avoidance of pain. And if we can get on very, very nicely together, it's good enough for us. You can keep your air sign theory. Now, the air sign type, in general, hasn't got that kind of feeling, but prefers a process of judging everything, evaluating everything perpetually, and therefore tends to lack feeling. But if you remember, Plato said, feeling is the unity principle in your body, and thinking is the disunity principle. It is thinking that breaks you up. It's analytic. It is feeling one that will renew your wholeness. So it's very important to see the difference. Now, in the case of the earth kind, we can see an illustration of what psychologically is called psychothymia, where we divide people into two kinds, schizophrenics and cycloids. The air sign, the intellectual, tends to split up into subsidiary personalities, which is called schizophrenia. The earth sign tends to be alternately depressed and elated, but he keeps always his own personality. It is always Maggie Mumps who is depressed, you see, and elated, and depressed and elated. If we take the extreme case of this, the insane people who are cycloid, they tend to commit suicide after a depression has just finished. Never in it. Because when they're thoroughly depressed, they can't do anything about it. But if they've been depressed and then they've been elated and then they've been depressed and elated in a continuous cycle, they get fed up of returning to a depression that they're just escaping. So when they're coming out of a depression, they get enough energy to commit suicide before they have time to reach the peak of elation and become depressed again. So there's a definite period for the cycloid type when we have to watch them very carefully, because they tend to do away with themselves, not in the depth of a depression where most people would think, but when they are coming out of it. Burma's terms, it would be a warning to all earth signs to avoid depression. And the way to avoid depression is very simple mechanically. Never allow yourself to be elated, and you can never be depressed. You see, it's again this waveform. If you allow yourself to go, there's your median line. If you allow yourself to go up, that is, you push the string up there, it must fly down again. So this is the way to conquer depression. Because in depression you can do nothing at all except sit and be depressed. You wait until you tend to be elated and you pull down that elation, knowing that if you manage to pull it down, you cannot be any lower the median line in your depression than you allowed yourself to be exalted above it. In Bible terms, the mountains shall be brought low and the valleys shall be exalted. Such symbolic expressions are psychologically significant in this way. So in dealing with an earth stressed person, a cycloid, a manic depressive type, the important thing is to teach them not to be exalted. They feel fine, they say, why shouldn't I feel fine? I've been depressed for so long. The answer is, that is why. If you do not pull yourself down when you're exalted, you must fly to the equivalent depth to the height you've allowed yourself to be exalted. And if they practice, lots of people I know that were very cycloid in temperament in this manner have completely cured themselves. The ideal is to get that tendency to exalt, hardly to move over the median line, so it can't go below it. You then get an even keel of life. You've got self-control. And you know that if you get excited and flip up, pull yourself down. And you know that if you've allowed yourself up and managed to pull yourself down, you will be pleased that you've done it. So that when you become depressed later, you will be equipped in your memory with the knowledge that next time you're elated, you can pull yourself down a bit more and the depression will reduce. So the characteristics of those people are, they're pitched in the physical body, they tend to be cycloid in behaviour, alternately depressed and elated. The cure is pull down the elation, and then the depression cannot occur because of that physical fact. The water signs tend to be rather easygoing and pleasure-loving. They're the most pleasant people in the world to get on with, for other people in general. They're not always the best people for themselves, because it isn't always possible in this world to enjoy yourself all the time. But that is their campaign. The air signs tend to split, because of their analytical processes, into many little subsidiary entities, so-called split personalities. You can see the mechanics of that very simply in this sense. Suppose you study arithmetic, and then you leave it alone and study foreign languages, and you leave that alone and study music, and you leave that alone and decide you'll go to the pictures for relaxation, during which time you eat chocolate and bananas and so on, and then you come out and decide that it's time you went the pace, so you go and get drunk. And you do all these different activities, and you never find the common factor in them all. Now, if you don't find the link factor between these different activities, what you are really doing is engramming on your brain, Samson's, knowledges of certain fields of activity which are quite discrete. They have nothing to do with the other activities. So there's no link factor. And then when the nervous energy plays through those parts, it operates so that a man, one moment, he's a very, very rational being. That's because he's practiced being logical for a time. And then during the next period, he isn't rational at all, because the energy now has moved. It can't stay always in the same place in the brain. It must move. When it moves to another place, then the fellow thinks, oh, I think I'll do a bit of music practice now. And halfway through that, the energy moves to another zone. He thinks, I'll go to the pictures instead. This is caused by the movement of energies through the different zones in the brain. And you know, each zone in the brain has a specific function to deal with the actions of the body. So, the important thing for dealing with the schizophrenic type is to give him the link factors that tie together all the different activities. A man goes to a football match, and another man hates football and likes cricket. You say to both of them, after all, it's a ball game. And you start telling them that they've got 11 in both. There's 11 cricketers, 11 footballers. Why 11? Why is a cricket pitch twice 11 long? Why are there 3 stumps? And so on. All these games are symbolical. They're ball games. And all the ball games can be linked together as games which are really metaphors of activities of the will. Because ball means will. Be all means the whole. Ball. Ball, with an O in, is the Greek form and the Latin V-O-L, vol, volition. This is the ball, the circle. Energy comes in and turns round. That's ball. This one is called vol, as in vulcan. The gentleman that hides underneath volcanoes and hammers. This is vol, and this is vol. That is individuated volition. So that when we talk about ball games, we're talking about will games. And the whole object is to pass that ball through an arch of some kind, isn't it? So in this sense, this represents the initiative power. Freud would have said, oh well, it's just a male symbol. And the goalpost is a female symbol. In the case of rugby, we use a letter H. Because rugby is only for decent fellows to play, isn't it? Now, can you see, symbolically, why in rugby they have an H goalpost instead of what is in effect a chet?
It's a spirit sign,
isn't it? Well, it's a sign of spirit. Now, supposing you take this, it's the diaphragm. These games were made by kings long ago to train their children. There's your diaphragm in the H, you see, and a footballer kicks underneath it all the time. But the rugby man who's training to be a gentleman, he has to get the ball over the bar, doesn't he? He must keep the will up. Now this is a method of linking for the sake of these skitsy type of people, linking together what these ball games are about. They're all symbolic. It's not accidental that they have it in a certain game for a certain class of people, a certain number of players. It isn't accidental that the ball has to be kicked over in rugby and kicked under for ordinary folk. Now, the more you can think about ball games in that way, that the ball equals will, and it's a masculine sign, and the goal itself is a feminine sign, spirit itself is feminine, prior to creation, because the positing is the first masculine. You know, the Latin macula means a spot. If we put an S in it, mascula. You see, that is the same as the masculine side. Men are the original spots or blots on the scutcheon of spirit. They're thrown in, that is like the Hebrew letter Yod, which you would draw just like that. That's a Hebrew Yod, which is our jot in English that Christ refers to. Not one jot or tittle shall pass away. Here is the goal, you see, that's head, hedge, limit. This yod is a drawing of a hand like that, and it means creative power, and it means the positor. Posit is that making of the point, po sit, but po is power, and sit means you put your power down, let it sit. So this yod, or jot, the Greek yota, is the jot or tittle that cannot pass away till all is fulfilled, because as long as things exist, there must be positing of power. And as long as there is positing of power, then nothing can pass away. And nothing is going to pass away until everything has fulfilled its purpose, and therefore not one jot can go away till all is fulfilled. It's just a question of the logic of it. Now, are there any particular questions you'd like to ask about any aspects of the zodiac that might help to clarify any particular issues?
Well, I find that I've got most of the other symptoms or behaviour patterns that you give to the birth signs that aren't particularly in the way of my own.
In what way?
Well, I find I've got a little bit of the... one time I didn't anyhow. It looks bad now.
Mm-hmm.
Getting very late and up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Right down to the depths again.
Mm-hmm.
The other earth sign of changeability, start to do something and decide to do something else. I think I've had the lot in fact.
Well now, this is a diagram of a human being, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a human being has these four parts inside him. We've analysed them out and dealt with them separately. But to deal with a human being, we must put them all back together and synthesize the whole man.
Right.
You're a Pisces type, aren't you?
Yes.
That means you've got a primary stress there. But that primary stress, being an emotional stress, has tended to link you to all the others, hasn't it?
Yes.
You see that? So because of that stress, in a real sense, your mind is very quick internally. And you attach yourself to a lot of things, don't you? And have done. Emotionally. So, we must remember that the whole man has all these things inside him, and the difference between one man and another as regards this wheel is stress only. That is to say, you are not merely one of those. You are all of these. There is always 11 of those subordinated to one, unless a stimulus comes outside. You see, supposing we stimulate your Gemini faculty and ask you how long is a piece of string. You've got to think about it, haven't you? That takes you out of Pisces for the time being and stresses Gemini. You see that? In you. Because you've got them all. If we found an emotional being to act upon you, you would understand what he was doing. Wouldn't you?
Yes.
But because you're looking for wholeness, you may not like him.
True.
In fact, very often, the people that we are most like are the people that we like least. Because they haven't got anything to give us. Now, the funny thing about this is, very often, people marry somebody on the opposite side of the wheel. And when they have babies, they frequently bisect the angles between them. This is an attempt on the part of nature to equilibrate all the time. Supposing all the giants married giants and all the smaller people married smaller people, we'd have had two races, wouldn't we? Of the very big and the very little. What we find is that tall people are fond of little round people, you see, and fat people are fond of thin people, and dark people like fair people. This is a device of nature's to guarantee that the human race manages to remain human. Otherwise it wouldn't be a race at all, it would be a multiplicity of different species, wouldn't it? So we have to remind ourselves that this is only a stress. And then we must add to it this, you are also not only born at a particular time of the year, but you are born of certain parents. So you have your biological inheritance as well as your birth position to consider. Also, you have the fact that you are born in a certain country and there's a certain tradition acting upon you. And you're born on the earth, aren't you? Not on Venus or Mars. Your specific gravity wouldn't be the same if you'd been born on Saturn as it is now. You see that? So first we must consider all these different influences. First of all, you derive from the infinite spirit, which is called the Godhead. Then you're whipped into the macrocosmic sphere. And then you're driven through the sidereal sphere, through the solar sphere, through the planetary sphere, into the Earth. You've already passed a lot of influences on the way, haven't you? Then you get into a certain country on the earth, at a certain historic period on the earth, with a certain tradition, in a certain family, with a certain biological heritage, and on top of that, in a certain house of the zodiac.
Just ain't no hope for it.
That, you see, that you must handle it very, very carefully. A lot of people say, oh, well, we know him, he's a fish. Cross him off. He's emotional. Now, that's foolish. Because the character of the external stimulus Everybody says it will sometime, isn't it, right?
Thanks.
Subject to this number of influences, which you have to remember, they're all valuable, you know. It's the same if you're studying anatomy, you have to study the different structures, you say, start with the skeleton, and then you hang on to its various major muscle forms and some similes and so on, say artistically. And to draw a figure of a human being in action, you have to remember an awful lot of things to avoid mistakes. Well, when you're trying to deal with a human being, remember first, he belongs to the Absolute Spirit, then he came into the universe, he's subjected to astral or sidereal star forces, cosmic energies, then solar energies, planetary energies, earth energies, national energies, particular family biological, and then the time process on top of that, and then external stimulation coming from outside to complicate the matter. If you make allowances for them all, you can be very accurate. And if you ignore them all, except one, then the particular time you have to go. It's surprising how close you can get to it, though. Now, for instance, if you take even the century we're born in, we are born in the 20th century, in the first part of it, and the 19th century inertia is riding over us still. We still believe in atoms by inertia. Atoms are a fiction. We still believe in electrons. They're another fiction. A man like Schrödinger says, well, they're logically inconsistent with themselves. Perhaps they're just wavy calls. You see, he takes the word particle and cuts the part off and keeps the echo, and then he tags a wave onto it and says it's a wavy call because it behaves like a wave and like a particle. This is an attempt to put together contradictories to explain something that's inherently contradictory. And they're all myths, in any case. In that sense, the whole of science is a myth. But it's a convenient myth. If I tell you that Prometheus stole fire from heaven, to which the gods got very annoyed and sent him a wife named Pandora, but Prometheus means forethought in Greek, so he wouldn't have that wife. He said, not for me, thank you. If the gods had sent me a present after I've stolen fire, it must be no good. So he refused it. But he had a brother called Epimetheus, which means afterthought. So he married her. And then all of a sudden the world started. That is a mythic statement. It's myth. It is valuable. It says forethought can dodge a certain amount of trouble, but it gets you into another kind of trouble. Because Prometheus was bound to a rock, and then an eagle came and tore out his liver every day. And in the night time he renewed it. But the eagle came back and tore it out again the next day, because he was a man of forethought. Now if we go into the world of business where men are forethinking all the time, they're Promethean men. And we find that liver trouble is one of their chief troubles. Because forethinking has to do with the liver. And when you're forethinking, you are really annoying yourself in a variety of ways and sowing all sorts of fears in yourself. And the ego is the symbol of the intellect. So it is your intellect, your activity, that's biting at you. That's Promethean activity.
How about Liverpool in this situation?
This is an amazing thing, you see. We go into Manchester and all the buses are red. We come here and they're all a funny kind of greeny blue, aren't they? The same colour that you see on copper, and the same with the lamp standards, can't they? Now, copper is a metal sacred to the goddess Venus, the goddess of Venusicism, and the liver is very closely connected with that activity. It's part of the geodetic revelation. Who persuades the corporation to paint their lampposts and buses in the appropriate colour of Venus? Does the Lord Mayor know about it?
They were red at one time.
Who persuaded them to change them?
I don't know.
You know Mars and Venus are opposite.
Yes.
Did we do the planets in their pairs?
No.
Have we done that?
Can you have a spare paper?
Yes.
These are more on the one. They're part of the planetary influences, but they're very simple to learn and very, very useful, and a very, very good circle. We take a circle and say that represents all that is. We draw it again and put a cross in it to represent each that is. And then we say we'd like to represent two different concepts out of this, so we'll cut the circle in half, like that, and take the cross out and put it at the top and put it at the bottom. And we'll then make a quick cursive sign like this and like this. Now that is the sign of Saturn as a planet. That is the sign of Jupiter. When the cross is over the semicircle, it means time over eternity, or contraction more than expansion. When this semicircle is over the cross, it means the expansion is dominating the contraction. Saturn means contraction. Jupiter means expansion. That's one pair. You just do them again. Saturn, time over eternity, or contraction over expansion, expansion over time. That's one pair. Saturn, Sat is being, and the urn thereof. The urn that contains being. The idea is that when the contraction principle of the universe dominates, you have made an urn of being. But when the expansion dominates, you have made Jewish God, Peter, Father, Jupiter. That's God the Father, because the expanded condition is prior to the contracted. Remember, the uncreated state of energy is prior to the created state. So Jupiter is older than Saturn. Now Saturn is called Kronos by the Greeks, isn't it? Time. Time. Time is a word in mit, throughout, backwards, because it depends entirely on the emission of energy. The time process depends on energy emission. Saturn, Kronos, time is the same as Satan, the devil. He's in opposition with God the Father, but they are both half circles of a whole, which is represented in Christ. And the sign for Christ is the sign for Hermes Mercury. There we are, the horns symbolizing the unbounded, the circle symbolizing the bound, and the material principle, the cross, crucifixion. So that represents the horns of your power on your head. This represents the feeling of your chest. And that represents the fixation in the sexual energy in the lower body. So there's your three-part man. And that is Mercury. So if we like to say it, we can write an equation that Saturn and Jupiter equals Mercury. We can, if you want, just go like this. And that is a legitimate equation in that sense. Now, Newton borrowed it from Jacob Boehme and said, forces in opposition, contraction and expansion produce rotation. This Mercury is Mercuri, to run, round. Running round, there's the Mer and the Merci. Mercury means to run round, and the running round is always caused by a contraction and an expansion together. So contraction, expansion equals rotation. That's a pair, and this is an odd one. You'll see why that is odd. It hasn't got one opposite to it. We have